It was in this very cathedral here, St. Mark's, that in 1953, I asked the bishop to become a postulant for the priesthood. And I wish I could see that bishop now. And so, you know, life, something, when I was in the Navy during the Korean War, I became interested in Buddhism. I was on a supply ship to Japan, and there I came across Zen Buddhism, and which was beginning to become quite fashionable in the Bay Area in 1955. So this was the thing that turned me toward in this direction. I was about 21 at the time. And so you ask yourself, what is it, you know, that inspired me or reached me in a way that no other religion or philosophy had ever done? And of course, this is something you can't really explain because I don't know myself. But when I came across, especially the Zen, the popular Zen forms that were available in those days, in the 55, the kind of D.T. Suzuki, Alan Watts, that style, Japanese Zen translated into English, something in me affected me very deeply what I might call an intuitive level. And so from that time on, then my main interest has always been moving in this direction in whatever way I could possibly do it. Because the 1950s, of course, there wasn't much available on Buddhism in English, at least that I knew of, because I used to go to the bookshops in San Francisco and look for anything that was possibly Buddhist without very much, there wasn't very much available at that time. So in 1963, I joined the Peace Corps and was sent off to Southeast Asia, to Sabah in Malaysia, which brought me into the Southeast Asian world, Theravada Buddhism. And from there, when I finished my Peace Corps contract of 2 years, I went to Thailand and started practicing meditation. Became a samanera for a year, a kind of novice monk, and then 1967 took the bhikkhu ordination and was sent by the preceptor to Ubon to train with Ajahn Chah. So then that was like 42 years ago, and this is a lifetime spent in this tradition, taking the Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths. That's been the form that I've meditated on and investigated for 42 years. Now everybody thinks it's kind of basic Buddhism, Four Noble Truths, first sermon of the Buddha, easy to remember, you know, it's not complicated. You don't have to be terribly bright to remember four things. But it's not as simple as that, because it is the whole style of the Buddha that appealed to me was this investigative invitation to investigate, to look into reality. I was a what you call a skeptical person, someone whose mind questioned all the time and couldn't take anything just because I was supposed to believe it or accept it according to the authorities. So this made it very, very impossible for me at the time to really understand Christianity, because I couldn't even accept the basic creed. You know, and so nobody offered me any alternatives at the time. Well, so the attraction to the Buddhist teaching was that it was an invitation to investigate life, consciousness. What's the purpose of a human life? What's the point of all this? You know, in so many ways it seems pointless. Are we here just to procreate the species? Is that all we're for? To destroy the planet like we're doing so well, to just gobble everything in sight and exploit all the resources until it finally falls apart? Or are we, is there no point? Is there no meaning? And what is being human? What is the value of this experience that we're all sharing at this very moment? Consciousness. We're all experiencing consciousness. We're all conscious entities sitting here in this room. And we're experiencing consciousness through this form, the human body that each one of us has. So this is a way of investigating, taking what is most obvious, you know, a kind of truth that can be just taken for granted or never questioned or never looked into in any serious way. We can be told we're here just by, because the Big Bang happened and we're here by accident, by some freakish accident in nature, or because we were created by a deity, or, you know, what is, you know, but we don't really know. We can accept others' views, scientific attitudes, or religious opinions about it. But the reality of this moment is, this is the way it is, this is what we are experiencing at this moment. Consciousness and within the limitation and the perspective of the human body. So then, from this point, you know, once we establish that, we start looking in the Four Noble Truths and the kind of Pali Buddhist way of teaching becomes very useful, because it's taking something that we all experience, the human experience of suffering or dissatisfaction, and placing that in a rather exalted position called a noble truth. Now, suffering or dukkha, and we use the Pali word dukkha, but it's generally translated as suffering or the sense of incompleteness or dissatisfaction or whatever way you experience most of your life is through the conditions that we've acquired after we're born. After we're born, when we're born, like a baby, newborn baby has a form, a body, and it's conscious. But it doesn't have a language. It learns the language after it's born. It doesn't have a memory in the way that we can remember what has happened in the past. We have a memory, you know, memory that lingers. We can remember all kinds of things from early childhood up to the present. We also are influenced by the parents, the attitudes, the biases, the prejudices, the assumptions of parents, ethnic groups, religious identities, the period of time we're born in, and so we acquire a sense of ourself after birth as this, I'm this body is me, and we identify with its gender, either boy or girl, we identify with the gender of the body, we identify with the color of the skin or the appearance, with the age of the body, and then we create a person, a kind of a personality from all this, about our self-worth, what we remember, who we are, our identity, our value, and so forth, is something acquired. So the Buddha encouraged us to investigate these acquisitions. Now, consciousness is natural. It's not something that is culturally created. It's not, it doesn't belong to any religion. it's just the way it is. Consciousness isn't something that is Buddhist or Christian. But it is reality, isn't it? Because we're all experiencing it at this very moment. The physical bodies we have are natural conditions. They're born and then they grow up and they get old and die. So this is just a natural way of birth of any creature, any animal on this planet. It has this process of birth, maturity, and then old age, death. So we are experiencing this consciousness through this form that we tend to not understand, that we are strongly identify with, that we have views and opinions. We suffer a lot about our appearance, about our age, about our gender, about the color of the skin, whether we're tall or short, fat or thin. We're strongly identified with the appearance of this form. And then we have strong views from the ethnic conditioning. So if you're, you know, what your parents, what whether they're white Anglo-Saxon Protestants or blacks or Asians or whatever, this is, we form a strong identity with what we're told about ethnicity and race. And then the American culture is one that's based on ideals. So we form strong ideals about how things should be. And so we are educated in that way, developing the thinking mind. We admire the modern educations about learning to think rationally, logically, intelligently, and the thinking process is acquired after birth. We learn the language that our parents spoke. We learn that, and then we think with that language. So we acquire the values of that particular ethnic background or religious background. We're told what's right and wrong, good and bad, true and false, about heaven and hell, about how things should be and how things shouldn't be. And so the whole dualistic structure of thought becomes our identity. We form strong attachments to thought, to thinking, and to memory. Like we all have retentive memories, so like coming when Janice was driving us here from Seward Park, where she lived, we're going through the very area that I grew up in, that I was born in, what is now, she tells me, is the Providence Hospital, which has changed its name because it belongs to the Swedish hospital. But in 1934, that was a Roman Catholic hospital, and I was born there. And I have a birth certificate to prove it, even though I have no memory, absolutely no memory of being born. And so that this is proof, according to this culture, you know, that I was born, that I am this person. But it does bring back memories, because just seeing the old buildings, houses, and that I remember from the early years of my life, because we lived in that area until I was about, till 1940, for about 6 years, when we moved to another place. So those memories of when I was, you know, first started noticing things to the age of six, were my experience of life. You know, I had no previous memories to work with or nothing to compare it with. So little details of this kind of minor things that one would never notice now become very powerful, and I can still recognize, like the pavement in front of the house that I first lived in for the first 6 years. I was there 3 years ago when I was visiting Seattle, and I looked at the cracks in the pavement. I remembered the whole thing, you know, something like cracks in the pavement. They still haven't repaved. Now, I wouldn't know the cracks in the pavement where I live now. But I mean, this pointing to what memory is, you know, how, and then these memories are retained and or recalled according to the conditions. So the conditions for those memories arise when you're in the setting of that where those memories were first experienced. So this is the conditioning process that we suffer from. We're strongly conditioned to see things from cultural conditioning, social conditioning, religious conditioning, the sense of ourself as a person, as a separate individual, as a personality, as an ego. We're strongly identified with the thinking process. So in the American culture, of course, it is very idealistic. So you're brought up with this attitude of how things should be if everything was perfect. You know, freedom, human rights, liberty, we have a right to happiness, everybody's equal, everything should be fair, there should be justice and fairness. We all should be good to each other and kind. We should treat each other with respect. We should and should. We know all the shoulds. You see? So then we, then these are ideals. And I'm not putting this down, but trying to point it out that when we attach to ideals, then our critical minds are set into motion because life isn't ideal. It's like this. It's the way it is. We have to experience, you know, old age is like this. It's not how an ideal old age I'm experiencing. This is the reality of it, you know. So it's you know, if I had the ability to, I could make a few modifications that I would prefer if I had the ability to control it. But this is what happens. So getting to know this, when I trained in Thailand, where I lived for over 10 years, of course, being a Buddhist culture, they're not idealistic like this. It has much more wisdom base to it. So there's a sense of the way it is in terms of an acceptance of life and its ups and downs and its changes. That was quite new to me when I first began to understand Thai language well enough and to appreciate their culture. So living in the northeast Thailand with Ajahn Chah for about 10 years, you know, I had a good mirror for my own kind of cultural assumptions, cultural biases, cultural conditioning. And I began to see what a critical mind I developed. I'd been through the universities and read a lot. I liked intellectual exercises and so forth. So I had, you know, a good mind, but I still found that this critical tendency was making me very unhappy because it seemed to, I was always discontented. Wherever I was, I'd always find something wrong with it, with myself or whoever I was with or with the society I'm in. And when I was in the Peace Corps, I was in a very kind of paradisical place, kind of tropical paradise in the state of Sabah, which is in northern Borneo. And there I was, became very apparent in a tropical paradise, very teaching English to little Chinese children for a couple of hours a day, very pleasant job. Easy life, going out snorkeling, having parties, and having really a good time for 2 years. And yet, with all the pleasures of living in a tropical paradise, I could still create so much anguish and guilt and despair over nothing. It was just, you know, it was habitual. It was a way of thinking, a way of dealing with life that I had no control over. At least at that time, I had no control over it whatsoever. So things would happen, or I didn't get my way, or something was said that would offend me. I could easily get pulled into anger or resentment or self-pity or resentment towards others. even though on one level, rationally, I could dismiss it and say, don't be so silly, don't be like that, they didn't mean it the way you're taking it, don't be stupid. I knew I had enough training on that level, but emotionally, it was an emotional habit that I could see. I was 30 at the time, 30 years old, and so I thought, 30 years old, my youth is gone. And I don't particularly like the results of 30 years the way I've been living. It's not that great. And I thought, 30 more years of acting, reacting like this is a nightmare, you know. So it did set me in the direction of Thailand. And I thought, my one kind of hope and interest at that time was in Buddhism. So it was there that I felt inclined to seek the answers to the existential questions, to the meaning of life. And of course, living there, and I was very fortunate when I went to Thailand, having found a very good teacher. And therefore, the effect of the meditation, the power of investigating the Four Noble Truths was encouraged, you know, and if you notice, that teaching itself is based on four truths and three aspects of each truth, and then the 3 × 4, 12 insights. See, I'm also good at multiplication. That's something I remember. So there's the 12 insights, 4 noble truths, 3 aspects to each truth. Now this is the beauty of this kind of teaching, because it's the first aspect is always a statement, and the second is a prescription, what to do about it, and the third is the result. So what I call this is a reflective way of investigating experience, taking something so banal, so mundane, so ordinary as one's suffering. It wasn't that I was being mistreated or abused, or my life had been one of deprivation and humiliation. I didn't have anything really to blame my misery on. You know, it wasn't because of lack of opportunities or poverty or anything like that, but it was just the sense of the self-consciousness, the absurd obsession that I had with myself as a person, the way I would cling to memories from the past, the way I could hold on to resentments when I felt I'd been mistreated in the past or not understood properly, the way I could feel sorry for myself. And yet I could judge these emotions on the intellectual level as, saying they're childish or foolish or whatever, but it didn't mean they ever went away. They'd come and go, and they'd operate. So just saying, don't be stupid, is not enough, isn't it? So it's like that with meditation, this was what I began to tune into when I started living with Ajahn Chah. Because the first year, I had to learn the language. No one could speak English there, so I had to learn the Thai language. So that in itself is frustrating, being in a society that you don't understand what anybody's talking about. And in a totally different environment, a very strict kind of disciplined forest monastery in northeast Thailand is very different from Berkeley, California. You know, I'd spent several years in graduate school in Berkeley. So there it was, you know, don't suffer, enjoy everything. and then, you know, everything goes, try everything. And then the monastery in northeast Thailand was full of prohibitions and restraints, and then learning to another language, and the frustration that one feels in trying to even say something simple and nobody understands what you're saying. So Ajahn Chah was very good at getting me to look at this, at not trying to tell me how I should be, but encouraged me to look at what I'm actually feeling. So I began to get the point, you know, through the limited means that we had for communication, but I did, you know, he was a very intuitive kind of monk, very wise and intuitive individual, so he could, you know, somehow reach me in a way that wasn't dependent upon a common understanding of the language. And so I spent the first year just observing myself. Now, in the Thai forest tradition, they trace their kind of roots to the great teacher of the past, Ajahn Mun, who died long before I ever arrived in Thailand. But he was called a forest monk, and he was obviously had a lot of insight into the Dhamma. And of course, the structure is based around the monastic discipline, living within the restraint and the limitation of the Vinaya discipline. But the whole import of it, the important message, was awareness, mindfulness. Now, this word mindfulness in English is rather, you know, I don't quite like the word myself, because you cannot define it. Now, I've heard so many people trying to define mindfulness, you know, with English words, or with Thai, or Pali. But mindfulness is beyond definition. And so we form views about what is mindful and what is not. And so then I kept trying to figure out what, when they talked about mindfulness, I kept trying to figure out, you know, how I wanted to be mindful. You know, I had this strong interest in becoming a mindful monk. And yet, no matter how hard I tried, I never could really feel I was succeeding very well at this effort. And so I was interested in getting samadhi or concentration. You know, so this was not so difficult, because we are trained to concentrate, you know, to focus our attention on one thing. And then shut everything out, but concentrate on the one object and really work at that. But mindfulness is this vague kind of awareness, ability that we all have to be fully present without focusing on a single object. And even though I could understand that in these terms that I'm using, I kept trying to think about it, to conceive it as something, rather than actually be mindful. So all the efforts of trying to become mindful, be mindful, and then it began to sink in. It's not a matter of becoming or being, you know, me, about me becoming anything, but of awakening, of opening to the present. So this sense of here and now, awakened attention here and now, it's a receptive, intuitive ability that human beings have. Every one of us has this. We wouldn't be alive today if we were never mindful. But our culture does not ever teach about this. It's not a part of our cultural expectation. You notice, like, idealism is not about mindfulness, is it? It's about creating, we can conceive of the very best of everything. Something that is totally beautiful, totally complete, totally true, absolute, wonderful, and all the superlatives you can imagine. We're quite capable of doing that. But mindfulness isn't about the best but about the way it is. Its ability, each one of us has to be fully open and aware of the way it is now, as each one of us is experiencing it at this moment. So getting back to that, the consciousness is the same. It's not about my consciousness and yours. It's not about American or Thai consciousness or Buddhist or Christian. Consciousness is this. And then the Buddha encouraged us to use the common ordinary experience of suffering, raising that to what he called the first noble truth. So notice this is it's not ultimate truth. It's a noble truth. So what's noble about suffering? You know, there's a question of what is it? Why place that kind of experience that none of us want? We don't want to suffer. We don't like it. Most of our lives we spend so much of our efforts in trying to find happiness and comforts and get away from suffering, that then the Buddha says suffering is the first noble truth. Now makes this as a suggestion, it's not a dogma, it's not a kind of thing you have to believe in, because you don't have to believe in suffering, you are suffering. It's a matter of admitting it, of recognizing this sense of me as a person, this identity with the body, this self-consciousness, worrying about what others think of me, a fear of being criticized or blamed for things, all the fear we have about, you know, what people might say, how we might be blamed for something, how we are worried about how we look, so people can't make fun of us, or we'd like to look in a certain way that is considered fashionable or attractive in the society we're in. And then we start criticizing our parents because we, no matter how attractive we might be, we can always find something we don't like about ourselves. So this sense of a self, of an ego, a person, separate person, is the very, you know, one of the main fetters or manacles that we bind ourselves to where we experience dukkha or the first noble truth. So then the Buddha's advice is to understand. It says the second aspect is dukkha should be understood or suffering should be understood. Now this is the prescription, what to do about this noble truth. Now it's noble because When I use the English word noble, it means there's something you're willing to look at that is unpleasant, unwanted, not beautiful, that maybe you've spent your whole life avoiding or reacting to, trying to get away from it, distract yourself with all kinds of other things just to get away from yourself, or your suffering, or your sense of feeling not good enough, or your guilt, or shame, or your critical mind. So then this sense of nobility, when somebody's noble, when they really face something, you know, that isn't, you know, something that maybe isn't, that is not pleasant, that they don't like, they don't want to see. So this kind of willingness to understand. So this English word understand is to really take a look, not to criticize, but to recognize this feeling of self-consciousness, of feeling incomplete or not good enough, or whatever ways that your personality operates. As you open to that, that you're using your awareness, your mindfulness starts going into, you know, you start being mindful of this kind of reality of your own discontentment, unhappiness, or self-consciousness, or resentments, fears. So then, this is and then the third aspect of the First Noble Truth is suffering has been understood. It's like this. It's like you see what it is—a reflective style. That there is this, what you should do about it, and the result of looking, of investigating. So the second aspect of each noble truth is about practice or meditation, or bhatipatthā in Pali. It's called. So there's through these noble truths we begin to investigate the cause, the second noble truth about the cause or origins of suffering, the third noble truth the end of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the fourth noble truth is the way to live within the limitation of the human form and not create suffering. So it's a very practical, useful, and a teaching that you can actually use in your life to investigate and to apply to your own experience, to your successes, failures, your ailments, your losses, your own sense of your self-worth, whatever form of limitation that you're bound to, you begin to look at it. Not from the critical mind, it's not to condemn, but to recognize. So what this is, the mindfulness then, is the ability we all have to awaken. Consciousness awakened is where wisdom functions. So the very word Buddha, just this word itself, is the key to it all. It means awakened. The very word itself means awakened consciousness of an individual. So in that Thai forest tradition, there's this, they use this mantra or this one word, Bhutto, they use as a kind of reminder. So when I went to stay with Ajahn Chah, this was, wanting to find out his method and so forth, I said Bhutto, and so, it was, and Thais say it in a different way. Say Bhutto rather than Bhutto, and so Bhutto didn't sound very inspiring to me. because I didn't quite get it at first that it was Buddha, but then also the reflection is the knowing, the one who knows, this sense of awakened consciousness with wisdom. So this is what the mindfulness allows us to be liberated from delusion, old age, sickness, and death. Liberated from death means what? Ajahn Chah did die, by the way. And in the scriptures, the Buddha, the historical sage, died. They have a euphemism for it, but you can just say died. So what is it mean? Did he didn't realize the ultimate truth because he died? Or then we reflect, isn't it? Consciousness now, mindfulness, consciousness, awareness is the deathless. Now this is not a dogma. I'm not asking you to believe it. But in your exploration and investigation through meditation, is you're taking these teachings and then investigating them. At this, you can conceive, try to conceive deathlessness with your thinking mind. So what is it that never dies, was never born and never dies? Now we can, in our tradition, we have immortal deities like Aphrodite or Zeus. but they were born, but they just never die. So, but that is not Dhamma, according to the Buddhist teaching. And so they have form, so you can create, you know, they're symbolic, aren't they? They're symbols of energies and that we all experience in the through our consciousness. But just asking yourself, what is the deathless, or this enigmatic word of nibbana or nirvana? Now, the thinking mind, I've heard many people talk about nirvana as the highest state. But that doesn't work, because that's putting nirvana into a conceptual framework. You see? And of course, then it becomes superlative. It becomes a superlative. It's higher than heaven. So then, smug, self-centered Buddhists say, Buddhism is better than Christianity because they have heaven, but we have nirvana. No. No, it's better than what you have, kind of thing. And so recognize that is how the thinking process works. Now, observing yourself thinking, you realize it is dualistic. A thought, it always has its opposite. So if you have heaven, there's immediately, you know, this opposite is hell. True and false, good and bad, right and wrong. And so when we attach to the thinking process, to reason and logic, not to dismiss these functions, but this ignorant, blind attachment to the thinking process, we always seen things in this very linear way, how things should be. And then we don't like the way they are, because we can see so many things now with the United States that we don't like about it. It shouldn't be this way. And, you know, it's based on ideals of human freedom, and it's not like that anymore, and it should be, and it shouldn't be. So we become critical, upset, angry, resentful, and that's the result of attaching to conceptual thinking. And so this exploration, investigation of the thinking process needs to be, is encouraged for you to observe. That which is aware of thought is not a thought. So then, when I first had that insight, I started thinking about not being aware of thought. Got my mind into a real twist with that one. So because, you know, you're trying to think about not thinking, and it doesn't work. Except you get confused by it. So then this is why the Buddha emphasized mindfulness, or sati sampajanya. These are Pali words, which convey this ability we have of awakened consciousness here and now. It's not about practicing meditation to get enlightened in the future. Now, how many of you practice, your meditation practice is about developing your meditation to become enlightened in the future? Because for most of us, that's why we started, you know, that's how I started. I didn't, you know, I was an unhappy person. I went to Thailand to practice meditation to try to become a happier person. And hopefully, even though at the time I had such low opinion of myself, I didn't think I could ever become enlightened. Because that's the way I saw the here and now. Always was through these distorted perceptions of me and mine, of myself. The habitual sense of me as this person, and this critical tendency to see myself through critical eyes, through disparagement, through exaggerating, emphasizing the faults I have, the weaknesses I see in myself, the imperfections that I don't like about me become the dominant way of perceiving and looking at myself, is through these negative critical forms. So the idea of meditating in order to become enlightened seemed to be the right attitude at the time. But then with that, with vipassana style of meditation, that meaning is looking into the way things are, examining, well then you begin to notice that the thinking process is conditioned and that you create yourself with your thoughts. You know, this sense of me is a thought. I'm an unenlightened person that needs to do something called meditation in order to, in the future, become enlightened, or to achieve a higher state, or to find happiness. So this is the thinking process, the cultural conditioning, and this, what we call this ignorance of Dhamma, or these Four Noble Truths, that is the very cause of our suffering. Why we can live in affluent comfort and privilege like many of you do in this country and still be quite unhappy or guilt-ridden or remorseful or worried about the future or resentful about past experience. So this is like awakening, and this is what I valued in my own experience as a Buddhist monk, was this sense of awakening. And then as you begin to recognize the value of awakening, Buddha, puto means awake, it means wake up. And it's not about me waking up as a person, it's about paying attention to life. Not about judging it, criticizing it, and trying to change it or ignore it or blame the problems of the world on others, but it's about awakening to conscious, the reality of our consciousness in this very moment here and now. So meditation then, in the word that is most significant in Pali language is bhavana. Now in the Thai language they use this word, that's their word for meditation, bhavana. But bhavana really begins with the Fourth Noble Truth. And that means that seeing the nature of suffering and not attaching to it. So this bhavana then is the cultivation of this way, what we call the Eightfold Path, in daily life. We're living our lives practicing a way, or you know, living in a way that we don't create suffering around the aging process of the body, or the losses or failures or misfortunes we might experience, not, or the successes and praise and good fortune that might come our way, or the boredom, the disappointment, the despair, the loneliness that one experiences in life. We all have to experience loss in our lifetimes, loss of the loved, separation from the love, what we love, what we want to be with. We see our parents getting old and dying. We see, you know, loved ones separating, going somewhere else. So we're experiencing loss as part of the human experience of life. Now this doesn't change just because you're mindful, but your way of noticing, of responding to loss is one of wisdom rather than of this ignorance and the grief and anguish and despair and following in, that we might create through our conditioned self-view. Now this is, all that I'm saying here is for consideration. You know, not to be grasped in any way. What I'm doing this evening is just trying to open up something for you to encourage you. Now we're teaching, in the West for over 30 years now. You can see that the problems that we have, because in Thailand, it being a Buddhist culture, they do have a kind of wisdom foundation to their, you know, whether they know anything about Buddhism at all, there's still a kind of wisdom aspect to that affects the people living there. And then let's take my experience here in Seattle, being born in the Providence Hospital and growing up in the 30s and 40s. And so forth in this city, and you know, there's conditioned to see things in the American way. You know, my generation, we were quite patriotic, and we had all kinds of assumptions that America was the best country in the whole world. It was just taken for granted. And I remember saluting the flag and feeling this pity arise, this tears coming to the eyes, and proud of my American heritage. And this is part of a cultural conditioning. Then I was brought up as a Christian in an Episcopal church, and it was a very kind of called high church Christianity. So it is very Catholic oriented, and so this was. This was very, I mean, it had beautiful qualities to it, but it was very dualistic the way it was presented. That if you doubt, you go, you know, is a sign that lack of faith and that you can go to hell for that, or that you have to believe in what the priest and the scriptures say, and to doubt that is wrong. So you're getting into this very dualistic way of thinking on the religious level. Now this, I'm not criticizing Christianity, but just pointing to the way I experienced it as I was growing up, the way I picked it up from my parents. So this is, you know, I was conditioned to think in these extreme terms, and ideals, the American ideals of democracy, freedom, equality, and all that, these great ideals. And then as I began to reach in my teen adolescence, a shift takes place. And, you know, I started questioning. Before that, there was no questioning. It was just mother, father say this, the priest says that, the Bible says this. You don't, you know, question it. They're the ones who know everything. And then when you're about 15, 16, you start wondering whether your parents know anything. And then you wonder about the priests when you lose that sense of their infallibility and their and on like that. So this the skeptical tendency began around in adolescence. Now then this skepticism led to being very critical, because I started criticizing everything. My parents, Christianity, American system, American government, everything. Everything. Nothing was right about any of this. And I could find so many things, you know, hypocrisy in Christianity and in the American system. I could see the inequalities. You know, they say everybody's equal, but it's obviously not true. And then the racial inequalities that existed in the 50s, and that was so obvious. And then and this idea of, and in Christianity, that all God's children were all equal, but then, as George Orwell says, some are more equal than others. So we think, is that, what kind of logic is that? So, because equality is an ideal, isn't it? And then more equal and less equal means that there's no equality. Well, start doubting all this. So this doubting, when I went to university and then went into the military and for 4 years, came back, finished school. But, and by that time, I had some kind of arousing of faith in Buddhism through this Zen style of the early mid-50s, because there you're encouraged to doubt, you know, to question, to look into things. And so this, I thought, this I can do this. and I'm not going to go to hell for it. So, you know, this exploration of Buddhism is not one of just being blindly attached to it or to this tradition, but investigating it. And so my life as a Buddhist monk in Thailand with Ajahn Chah wasn't just because he became an idol for me and that I believed everything and that I was told, because I couldn't do that. But it was because I was encouraged to really look and investigate how I felt about it, how I felt about restraint within a strict disciplinary form, how I felt about my emotional reactions to celibate life, to living a celibate life. How do your emotions do in regards to that? About, you know, when you're living in a monastic community, you know, there's still these interrelationships of feeling frustrated and angry and jealous and annoyed with the people you're living with. So, you think all Buddhist monks, they're so angelic that you just live in total harmony. That's not true. Living with Buddhist monks and nuns is the same as any place else. The personal reactions, the emotional reactions to living with basically good people. You know, like the monasteries I've lived in Thailand and in England, people I live with, they're all good, honest, you know, trustworthy people on the moral level, and they're trying to do their best, most of them, I think. But there's still a lot of, I like this one, don't like that one, this one is really annoying, that one is too much to bear, and on like this. But then the way is not to try to make monasteries into what you want, but using a monastery for observing the suffering and the causes of suffering in order to see the end of it. So what the effect of this kind of practice then leads to a sense of, you know, of letting go of condition, not destroying, it's not a destroying things or annihilating anything, but letting go of this blind, habitual, obsessive attachment to emotional habits, to views and opinions, attitudes, memories of the past, ideals that I cherish. It's not a destruction. It's not a condemnation. It's a liberation from them. Meaning that letting go doesn't mean getting rid of. It means releasing that blind, conditioned grip we have on the conditioned realm, to realize the unconditioned, or the deathless. So then this is the deathless is reality. The deathless, nibbana, this is real. This is not the highest form of happiness. This is reality here and now. Now just contemplate that, you know, when you think about it, you say, nibbana here and now, what does that mean? You have to work hard to get nibbana. That's the thinking mind, isn't it? That's how we grasp a concept. Or we ask, how many Thai monks, excuse me, have realized nibbana? Or did Ajahn Chah, was he an arahant? And I've been asked questions like this. And this is because this is the thinking mind grasping the concepts. The bodhisattva, the arahant, the stream enterer, the bhutuchana, or the unawakened individual, these are words, concepts like any other. But what are they pointing at? And this is where we don't look outward to look for an arahant, but, you know, to see, try to figure out whether Ajahn Chah was or not, but to observe that in ourselves that creates the illusion, that wants to know. So, for example, I encourage you to really observe the sense of yourself as a person, to not to criticize it, but to just recognize it. Now, observe that that which is aware of you, your person, your thinking mind, your identity with your body, your memories, your views and opinions, that which is aware of that is not that. Like your views and opinions change, your emotions come and go according to other conditions. But that which is aware of that change. And so this is like inquiring into this reality here and now. This awareness is the gate, is the door, is the only possibility any of us have as human beings for liberation from delusion and ignorance. And so these essential teachings of the Buddha are for. They're not for grasping or for belief or for denial, but for investigation. So see the opportunities you have of taking your own unhappiness, whatever forms of despair, anguish, or self-consciousness, whatever, using that not for analysis. You don't need to know why you feel like this, but to recognize that at this moment the emotional feeling at this moment is like this. It's the way it is. And as you open to that reality, you'll begin to be aware of its changing quality. You're not trying to get rid of it. If you judge it, then you don't notice it as it actually is. You conceive it as something, you know, me, and then you have a whole scenario you react to from that grasping of it. So this is where the encouragement is towards this awakening, observing, discerning, noticing, paying attention. And no matter what you're feeling, whether you're feeling happy or miserable, angry, greedy, you know, jealous, frightened, which we tend to judge ourselves about these things, because ideally we don't want to be jealous and frightened, do we? And we don't want to be angry. If somebody says you're an angry man, that's an insult, you know. You don't like to be, you know, I don't want to spend my life trying to make myself angry, but anger is, when its anger arises, there's an awareness of it. That awareness then is not anger, but the awareness embraces the anger and allows the anger to be what it is. Then you begin to notice the feeling of anger, its impermanence, it's anicca, it's impermanent. It's an energy. And if you're patient with it and don't try to suppress it or get rid of it, you can allow it to be what it is, and then it natures to cease. And you realize non-anger is like this. So this is discerning. This is the wisdom, the punya, wisdom. Discerning, grasping anger is suffering. Letting go of anger is non-suffering. And so then when you cultivate this, or the bhavana from this point, then it integrates into your life. It's not just about controlling an environment for peace and no distraction. It means that we can cultivate awareness through our lives as we have to live them, through the families that we have, through the work professions, the experiences that we all have, and that we will have till we die. It's about not creating suffering about the way it is. So I'll stop here, and we still have, Rodney said, we still have time, I believe, for questions. Yes?
Having spent quite a lot of time in the West and the East. Do you think that there are challenges that are specific to the Western mind, that we as Westerners have in understanding Buddhist principles that are different from people from the Eastern traditions, perhaps?
Well, the problems that we have are lack of faith. Most of us become Buddhists as adults, and so we don't have a kind of cultural connection to it. They say in Thailand they have a cultural connection. They're like teaching meditation in Thailand. People are culturally kind of, like Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. These things are part of their cultural conditioning, which are not a part of ours. And so we tend to be, the people that are attracted to Buddhist meditation generally are educated people. So you find that they're very questioning, skeptical, critical people. And so there's a lot of, that's where this particular style that I've learned through is the faith now is very strong in, but it's through investigating, not through cultural conditioning. And so this is where my upachaya, my preceptor, the first teaching he ever gave me was the finding the balance between faith and wisdom. Because in the Pali tradition, is that they're not opposed to each other, like they tend to be in the way we think in the West. Like the faith type, meaning you believe, just in angels and gods and that, and it's kind of dismissed as not being very bright, and he's a skeptic, he's very intelligent, highly intellectual, discriminative, and that's considered praiseworthy. This is generally speaking, of course, but in the Pali form, the faith and wisdom are balancing each other. So that's where this particular style of the Four Noble Truths is a way to, because it's not about believing, but about exploring. So through that exploration, when you have the insights through that form, then you're doing that with wisdom, and then the faith increases. Then you begin to think, well, that's true, that works, and then after 40 years of practice, faith is powerful. I have no problems anymore around this. Because I've been able to prove it. Not that I'm attached to tradition or monasticism, but because I've used it for this, then I have a lot of confidence. So in this way, say that the Pali word sadda is more like confidence, rather than faith is a dodgy word because it can mean blind faith or it can mean, faith can be used in different contexts. But sadda is generally translated as faith into English, but maybe confidence and trust that you get through finding the result. The results of having of mindfulness is like this, so it increases your confidence in doing this, in cultivating this way. Yes? Well, it is, like Ajahn Chah could see, like an American, patience is not one of the things we were encouraged to develop. And so, you know, I want instant, you know, the land of, you know, instant. I want something now and I don't want to wait for it. And then in this monastery in Ubon, you know, it was very, there was no kind of modern conveniences, no electricity or no mattresses on the floor, nothing soft, and to sit on hard surfaces, sleep on the mats and things like this. And then the monastery was, you had to conform, everybody had to conform to the way things were done there. And so, you know, then part of this was Ajahn Chah was at his peak, in his kind of teaching years. He was brilliant. But, of course, I couldn't understand anything he said. And he could go on sometimes for 5 hours, you know, every evening we'd meet in the sala, and there were monks and nuns, and then there were a lot of lay people. Because he was a very charismatic person, and he attracted people from all over. So here they would be, you know, sitting, and he was very humorous too, had a very good sense of humor. So here they were, he was talking, and everybody was having a good time except me. If anything makes you angry, it's that. So then I said, you know, I thought I was being reasonable. I said, you know, because I don't understand the language and it's so painful to sit. You have to sit in a certain way when you listen to a Dhamma talk, you see, which I found excruciating. So then, you know, I thought, I have to sit like this and then I don't understand what he's saying. It seems perfectly reasonable to ask permission to leave during this time. I could really practice meditation. And he would have none of it, he said. And so this was, I felt he was being unfair, you know, I felt angry with him, but somehow I was willing to do what he said. I did, there was a kind of trust that I felt when, even though I didn't agree with him. But then he said, you know, you have just develop patience, because that's, you're lacking that. You need to be patient. Well, I had plenty of opportunities to develop patience there. And so, I would do that. I'd sit through these long, interminable talks that everyone enjoyed but me. And going through emotional, you know, the gamut of emotions, from trying desperately to be grand and magnanimous about it and glad for all the people enjoying themselves, and then just wanting to get up and run away, you know. So these different emotional states would manifest. But I began to observe this, you know. There was nothing else to do but observe. And so I did that. And I learned a lot, you know, I could see how, even when I was most angry and most fed up and felt that I couldn't stand another, you know, I'm going to leave. If he's going to treat me like this, I'm getting out. I don't have to put up with this. I'm fed up. And then but I actually can stand it. So, to see this kind of negative thing in me that always saying, I'm fed up, I can't take any more, I'm not being respected properly. And I began to doubt the validity of these thoughts, these feelings. And I could see they didn't last, because he also had, he was very kind. So at the end of one of these long talks, you know, he would look at me and they'd end the evening session, and he'd give this beautiful smile, smile directly at me, and then all the anger would be gone in a flash. What was that about? You know, here I was ready to strangle him. Now I'm madly in love with him. What's that about? You know what? No, it's not questioning. You see, you're questioning your own emotional habits. You know, can I trust these emotions? I'm fed up. Can I trust that? I mean, it's very insistent and very real at the time, but it's very deluding. Whenever I've followed that, I usually, made terrible mistakes. So. And what I realized very much in those early years there was the kind of foundation I received of patience, and also being an alms mendicant. Like we can't have money, and we have to live on alms, what people offer. And so this is reflected on every day, every morning, evening. You chant these. Chants about, about living on alms, and that we're dependent on the generosity of others, and reflections of this nature. I began to feel a sense of gratitude arise, because people were very generous, and everybody, I could feel everybody wanted to help me, support me. There. They were all eager that I become enlightened. I began to think, that's better than what my parents wanted me to do. Parents didn't want me to be enlightened. So here with all these people, monks, everybody, encouraging me. And so by reflecting in this way, I began to, and people coming, preparing food, offering it. And then when I first went there, everything was built, the kutis, the little meditation huts, and the size of everything was built for Thai-sized monks. So I was the tallest monk they'd ever seen in this monastery. And so they gave me a new kuti, a newly made kuti. They very, thought this was, they'd give me this very nice kuti, but everything in it was, I'd hit my head on, to get in the door or then the beams, I just had to bend over most of the time to stay in that kuti. And so then the following year they started building them taller. and then I didn't, the Thai robes, the kind that Thai monks wear never fit me. So they started making special robes, and all this kind of kindness, consideration, and eagerness to help me in this endeavor began to feel, and then this contentment. This kind of life leads you toward is a sense of contentment. You don't need much in it. You're grateful and you're content with what is offered, and so this is a very strong foundation for awareness, that really gives you a place to operate from, to reflect on, because you aren't thinking of, I can't really practice unless I have this, or it's like that, or the food's not good enough, or you go through these things where you think it's too hot, too many mosquitoes. Wat Bapong was a big monastery with lots of people. I wanted a quiet place where there weren't so many people. I wanted more isolation. I wanted, not to have to do all the things with everyone else, and sit through long talks I didn't understand. And then, of course, I began to see this as the suffering and my grasping of it. This would lead to suffering. If I let go of it, then I began to be aware of I could bear with all this and not suffer. That the mosquitoes weren't the cause of suffering, or long days in a language I don't understand. It was my aversion, my hatred of mosquitoes, my wanting something I don't have, me not wanting what I have, you know, wanting something better than this. I could see this very clearly, that once I started grasping these desires, then I was thrown into this vortex of wanting something, discontentment, critical mind, fault finding, and no contentment at all, no gratitude. So it's like, as you explore that, then that you realize that the value of the monastic tradition is that it gives you a very strong foundation for bhavana, for examining, for investigating the Four Noble Truths. And that's what I really was interested in. I wasn't interested in comfort or that, you know, because it was the most uncomfortable place I ever lived in, but in having, really getting out of this miserable habitual self-view that would follow me to tropical paradises or wherever. Wherever I went, it would go along with me. So in Buddhist monasticism also, it's boring, you know, chanting, you use monotones, you don't, it's not like Handel's Messiah or anything like that, you know, monotonous chanting and then, you know, but that's the point, is that the form is not a kind of to be grasped, it gives you a structure to reflect from. And so you're not to grasp it, but to kind of live within that structure, to observe your own conditioned habits and sense of self. So this is like something really marvelous at this time, that there is this kind of interest in this kind of teaching. Because, like when I went to live in Asia, when I was living in Berkeley, this was in 1962-63, there wasn't any interest. The beatnik thing had kind of died out or moved somewhere else. The hippies were not in the public eye yet. They were busy taking LSD in Haight-Ashbury. I was a student at Berkeley, and people were into causes, you know, like free language, freedom of speech, and all that kind of thing. So there were protests, peace marches, protests, and I tried to get involved in all that, you know, the good causes. But nobody was interested in Buddhism or meditation. And so then the idea of going to Asia was, of course, foremost in my mind at the time, and the Peace Corps was the obvious way to do it. President Kennedy had started it the year before, and so I signed up for it, and they sent me off to Malaysia. And Kennedy was assassinated during my training period. I was in Hawaii, and so that was another terrible disappointment. We were all enthusiastic about President Kennedy. And so then the Peace Corps took me into the Southeast Asia, and from there brought me into the Theravadan Buddhist world, and this is the result. Yes. Yes.
And to practice just being with it. I'm wondering what there seems to be a fine line between accepting something and actually and doing something about it. So, and I have a conversation around that
in regards to being right or wrong? Because it seems like there's something that's not working to just learn to practice being okay with it. So how do you get to that next step where you actually, where you want something, but you're also accepting it at the same time?
It's a very good question. Because, I mean, this is the problem of language, is it? That does sound like, you know, the way I talk, or like mindfulness is just kind of a passive acknowledgement of things. But actually what happens is that once you accept something, your ability to respond to it is no longer bound by prejudices or emotional habits. So it's like a spontaneity and an ability to respond to contingencies, and that both internally and externally is enhanced. So generally the way is to do, you know, the sila or the moral commitment is on action and speech in the world, in the society. We determine to do good and speak on what is true, and to not act on harmful, divisive impulses. But in terms of mindfulness, we accept both equally: good impulses, bad impulses, good and evil, true and false. Our ability to respond, either through not acting or through acting, would be called spontaneity. And it's coming from a wisdom level rather than from just conditioned sense of right and wrong anymore. Because we can do a lot of harm by doing what we think is right, but not having real discernment or sense of when it is appropriate to act or when it's not. So this gives you that perspective. So that sometimes, in a particular situation, it's right, you know, it's better not to do anything, or there's something to do about it. And that's more from spontaneity and from the wisdom level rather than from a prescription or an ideal we might have. So it's like we begin our life then is one of much more like blessing the world, and where a relationship to others and to the environment is, you know, like we can begin to see human beings, we're quite capable of blessings operating through us, not from personal, you know, like taking it personally, like I'm a blessing to the world as a person, but as we free ourselves from those illusions, then human beings are like great blessings. They shower blessings onto this society, onto the planet, onto the environment. And this is, from the very pessimistic view, you know, like we tend to think of human beings as selfish. We're very self-centered, and we just, want everything for our own comfort and convenience at the expense of the environment and the society and the world in general. We can see ourselves, because that's oftentimes how it looks. But this is what I realized very much living with somebody like Ajahn Chah was, his life was a great blessing to many in ways that, you know, because he was mindful and wise. And he wasn't going around trying to bless anything. He made himself a vehicle for that to come through blessings. Because we live in this universe we live in is blessed. We're experiencing, blessing all the time when we let go of our ignorance and our attachments to the conditioned realm. And so it's not a kind of meaningless, empty annihilation of self and a judgment against cultural conditioning and language and thought and critical mind, but it's learning how to getting outside the limitation of the condition to realize the reality of the unconditioned. Now, saying that this is the reality, it's real, it's here and now. Consciously, we recognize it. It's this ability to be aware brings our conscious experience not from conditioned habits of self or emotional tendencies or thoughts, but it's the reality of now that we recognize. That's recognizable. And this is what sati sampajanya, these words in Pali, mean. And of course, when you think about it, then it gets off. So it's like it is an act of faith, of total surrender to this present moment. And of course, these kind of words from a self view seem, create doubt. Can I really, as Ajahn Sumedho, totally surrender to this moment? And am I really surrendering? And I'm thinking again, you see. So it's seen through that, of no longer feeling you have to figure it out. But as you tune into it, open to it, then affirm it. This is the Nibbana is the reality of now, of non-attachment. The unconditioned, the deathless is this. And then your perspective on the conditioned realm is, you see it in terms of through compassion, through love and compassion, through that kind of response to life comes through awareness and non-attachment. So they talk about the four Brahma Viharas in Theravada Buddhism, the Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka. They're called the sublime abodes, or and they're like loving kindness is metta, karuna is compassion, mudita is joy, and upeka is equanimity. And those are the English words, but they're not personal. They don't come from Ajahn Sumedho trying to metta for things. It's when you're really trusting in the awareness of here and now, the metta is reality. This is what holds everything together. This is the deathless. This is real. This is the Dhamma. It's not about when you start thinking about things, then you divide everything up. This is right, wrong, good and bad. But metta, loving kindness, even in its formulaic style, is about receiving life and all its aspects, both good and evil, equally, with kindness and non-criticism. It's not about approving or judging, but this ability that we have, like unconditioned love. Love is the very basis of this practice, in the sense of metta. And then compassion, karuna, responds to the suffering that we see around us. Because we understand suffering not from a personal view about it anymore, but because we understand it from our own investigation of it. And we feel compassion, and then we feel joy at the beauty and goodness of the universe we're living in. And equanimity, or emotional balance. We're no longer just helpless victims of conditions. One is equanimous and peaceful is your very nature. The natural way of consciousness is equanimity. And then we create emotions into that. So like the self, the ego, is a creation. When we bind ourselves to that limitation, then we're stuck in that limitation. We experience life always from the very personal, conditions we have. We're bound by our cultural conditions. So whatever you know, whatever that might be, you acquire the values, the views of right and wrong and how things should and shouldn't be according to, you know, what you've acquired from your parents or your ethnic experience or religion. And then the thinking process is seen, you know, so say English for me is my, you know, the language I learn. But it also can be just a very habitual thing, you know. It's a habit you develop, just think, and wandering mind, and the thinking process goes on and on around, I like this and don't like that. But now the thinking process is much more used, like skillful use of it, rather than just a kind of boring habit, you know. Like I used to, when I first started meditating, my mind would just think about the most silly things. You know, and I always hated that. I always wanted to get rid of the thinking process. And so I'd try to stop it and make it worse. But that which is aware of thinking is non-thinking. You know, so you're discerning the difference. I would intentionally think things and watch myself thinking them. So, because I couldn't stop thinking, this is a willful act of making myself stop thinking. I could stop it for a second, and then it would all start up again. But this, instead of intentionally thinking, and so I'd take the word bhutto, the mantra, and I'd say, if I think this word, you know, there's a point, you know, I began to notice that before I think it, there's no word. It's like this. And then I think, intentionally think, bhutto. And then after I finish thinking bhutto, then there's nothing there. There's no, started noticing. I never noticed that. You know, because when you're attached to thinking, you're always going in this linear progression of one thought connecting to another. Or when you get bored, you distract yourself, you go eat something, or switch on the television, or do something to get something else. But when you're in meditation, you're kind of looking and observing a thought and the space around thought, how thought arises in consciousness. When there's no thought, it doesn't mean I'm unconscious. I kind of fall into unconscious state. There's consciousness and no thought. You know, so it's like a discerning ability. And that then you begin to become very clear, you know, what is, how you create, what your personality really is, and how to be free from it. Not getting rid of it, but no longer bound to it and stuck in personal habits and emotional tendencies. So it's not a passive life like a pro, you know, like being able to when you have this perspective, then your ability to respond to contingencies is excellent. Whether it's doing or not doing, you know, it's intuitive then. Like I used to think, doing is always good, not doing is being lazy or irresponsible. But sometimes it's better not to do anything or say something. You know, when I felt, you know, I used to feel righteous. I'm right and that monk is wrong and I've got to set him straight. So I say, come here, you know, you're wrong. And you should... And of course, I'm right. But he cannot appreciate the fact I'm right. He just feels I'm scolding him and that I'm abusing him, and he feels put down and angry with me. So it's better if I didn't say anything. Till, if I trust this awareness, this intuitive sense, then there will come a time where maybe he will listen, or he's right, he's ready, he trusts me enough to listen. But if I'm just preaching and patronizing him and telling him, then even though I might be right about what I'm saying, he's being treated like he's stupid and patronized, and that I know better than he. So it's he's justified in feeling angry because I'm coming from a self view that I know what's wrong with him, and that I don't like him to be like, he shouldn't be like this. He should be the way I think he should be, and so then there's no hope of finding any solution to that problem except avoiding each other. But in this way, we begin to flow with situations, and then there is time, if you trust your intuitive sense, then there is a time where you know that time, you feel it, you sense this is the right time to say this, and it will be received and appreciated. And you know when it's not, when the person is not going to listen, and when your own state of mind is, you're saying this because you're really irritated with this person, so you're just expressing your irritation by accusing him of being wrong.